Hey teachers, if you're tired of not knowing how to create your lessons that reach EL newcomers in your classroom in a way that your content is actually accessible to them, and you no longer want to be limited by the constant push to move your ELs forward without concrete understanding behind why simple accommodations in your already existing lessons make all the difference for the newcomers, I have something exciting to share with you. I have compiled every masterclass I have ever recorded on how to teach and reach English learners in a regular education classroom. I am talking strategies, how-tos, and ready-made resources, and have created a digital masterclass library called Light the Way to EL Teaching Success, where you can get instant access to 10 practical and actionable videos, 8 done-for-you lessons, and 1 professional development certificate for 3 hours of your time. If you are looking for practical PD that you can do on your own time and gain all the knowledge you need about teaching English learners from the comfort of your home, Light the Way to EL Teaching Success Digital Masterclass Library is for you. To learn more and to join, click the link in the show notes, and I cannot wait to see you inside. You're listening to episode 107 of the ESL Teaching Podcast. Teaching English learners in the mainstream classroom takes teamwork, and in my opinion, it is important to see working with English learners from all perspectives. My today's guest, who also happens to be my dear colleague, Zach Kamenker, and I talk about connection, collaboration, and the necessity of adaptability in teaching, especially when we work with English learners. Zach has been a member of the English Language Arts faculty at the Ross Alergio Middle School in Bedford, New Hampshire since 2017. During his tenure, he has sat on a variety of committees, coached students in the drama program, and served as a building representative for the Bedford Education Association. Zach also worked with adult refugees and new Americans at Second Start in Concord in the summer of 2022. He happily serves on the steering committee member for the New Hampshire Jewish Film Festival, the board of directors for New Hampshire Humanities, and as a religious school educator at Temple Beth Jacob in Concord. He has done freelance writing for St. Paul's School, the New Hampshire Jewish Reporter, and Red River Theaters, an independent art house cinema in downtown Concord, his home city. A big movie fan, Zach enjoys anything cinematic, a good book by the lake or pool, and spending time with family and friends. And in today's episode, while we're not touching upon on his big passion film, we do talk about Zach's experience as a language arts teacher, what moved him to acquire a master's in TESOL, how he approaches working with English learners at varying proficiency stages in his classroom, how to foster connections with students and teachers alike, and so much more. It was a truly, truly great conversation, and one that has been in the plans for quite a while, so I am so happy we finally sat down and recorded it. Are you ready to listen? Let's get to the episode. Hello and welcome to the ESL Teaching Podcast. I'm your host, Yeva Grosslis, otherwise known as Simply Yeva, and I am so thankful that you tuned in. I'm looking forward to sharing both my knowledge and experience on this podcast, as well as that of my fellow teachers. Hi, Zach. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Yeva. It's so good to be with you. I'm such an admirer of everything you do.
Oh, thank you so much. And you know what? We've talked about it for a long time, and we work together.
Yep.
So we see each other every day. So finally, this is coming to fruition. And I'm so, so excited about our conversation and what you're going to share with us, because I admire what you do. So,
well, thank you. I know we've worked together for several years now. So the admiration, it goes both ways, because we've been through some really great things and some really trying times through the pandemic.
Yeah, absolutely. Too, so. Oh, my goodness. Yes.
Yeah.
Let's dive right in, and let's start with the first question, right?
Sure.
What is your backstory? How did you decide to become a teacher?
So I come from a family that people either sort of chose the teaching profession or the medical profession. And it's so funny. I feel like that's how it works for a lot of people with their family dynamics.
Yeah.
So my grandfather, so my mom's father was a teacher at Boston Latin School for many years. He died before I was born, but he was a pretty accomplished foreign language teacher and department chair. And my mom is right about at the end of her teaching career. She's retiring in June. So she's been 35 plus years in public schools working with preschool through second grade, specifically kids with moderate disabilities. So I've grown up around teachers. I have aunts and cousins who work in the education profession too. And I think a lot of them really inspired me to work with others and to serve students. And when I was in high school and college, I worked with a lot of younger student populations, whether through tutoring or I was a resident assistant in college for freshmen when I was an upperclassman. And I always really enjoyed influencing folks on their own journey to kind of figure out what their future would look like. And for me, it was always in the back of my head as a definite possibility that I'd go into teaching. But I think I solidified it early on in college that it was absolutely for me. And I always loved English, so that was my go-to. I always loved English and language, and I've been at it for 8 years now, and I love every minute of it.
Very nice. I remember when you started. I think, when did you come to our district? I think it was like 5 years ago, six,
It was actually, this is my 7th year, so
seventh year. Yeah,
fall
I
of
remember when you
2017.
started. Yes,
It feels like
but
just yesterday.
yeah, but it feels like you blended right in, and it was like so nice to see, somebody come in and being open and interested and just, I don't know, it was just like I still remember, how you've grown from all of these years. So it's amazing.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, being surrounded by such good colleagues in our district, we're so lucky. We really are.
I know, yes, we are. So you are, as you mentioned, a language arts teacher. Okay. So, well, working with middle schoolers, it takes a special kind of talent. The things they say, the things they do, the logic or lack of it. Okay, so tell us about your typical day.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. We all kind of joke that you have to be a little insane to buy into the middle school model. But what I love is while every day looks the same schedule-wise for me a lot of the time, no one day is the same because you're confronted with different situations, different problems, different opportunities, very positive ones a lot of the time. So as much as each day is, beginning with my homeroom, usually a group of kids, about 20 each year, who kind of have me as their home-based teacher. As much as each day starts with that and then shifts to, teaching usually two longer block scheduling classes. So we follow, as a block schedule of 80 to 90 minutes every other day. And there's a lot of positive to that from a teaching perspective. So I see four groups of ELA students. This year I have just over 80 kids between those four groups. But each day I see two sets of them essentially. And we meet for 80 to 90 minutes. I divvy up my teaching into different sections. So we usually do a big chunk of reading skills, a little bit of writing, some grammar or language pieces. And then, because I work in a what's called a pod or a team with a fellow math, science, and social studies teacher who all see the same kids as well, we have some unstructured time or less structured time where we work with the kids on different skills, or where we might have a silent reading block where they kind of work on different literacy pieces or the other reading that they're keeping up with in class. So it's a really fun way to approach the day, I think. My days, I find, go really fast with the block scheduling. What we're noticing now, the last couple of years, though, and I'm excited that we're embarking on this as a school, do we need to make schedule adjustments? Are 80 to 90 minute blocks slightly too long? Would, 60 minute blocks be a little bit better? And I'm not sure there's a clear answer, but I do know that in my day to day, and in my typical day, I'm noticing more and more that Sustaining attention for that long, even with the movement breaks that we do, can be hard. And, a happy medium might be perfect because a lot of schools do 45-minute blocks, and that's not quite enough, at
No.
least for especially for the ELA content.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned the time because I've always, as an ELL teacher, for me, it's different area because in our district, especially in the middle school this year, I have few students, and there have been instances when I have one student. So 90 minutes can be long if you don't have a clear like connection or a clear plan, or if you're only relying
Absolutely.
on supporting them on the content area, which sometimes they need, sometimes they don't need, sometimes, which is where collaboration comes in, and we're gonna, talk a little bit about it. So it will be interesting to see. I know a lot of teachers have either not enough time or like a lot of time, and for a classroom at the high school, we have 77 minutes. And it's a perfect amount of time. It really is a perfect amount of time. But again, it depends on the number of students. When you have one or two students, it's a little time goes differently.
Oh yeah. I think it's a good question to ask, what is a good amount and does it
Yeah.
vary subject to subject? Because I know ELA and science both feel like the longer time helps with
Of course.
writing, with labs, but some of the other subjects, math in a way would love to meet, a lot of them would love to meet every day for 50 minutes.
Yeah.
And happy medium, it's what it's all about. So collaboration with my team is a huge part of my day as well, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. So a few years ago, you came to me and asked me to be your mentor when you were pursuing your master's in TESOL. What made you decide to go in teaching English as a second language?
Yeah, so people ask me all the time, especially because, these last 3 years since I finished my master's, I've stayed in the mainstream ELA classroom. And I really had sort of three big reasons that I decided to pursue it. The first was I wanted to do something different with my master's than what I had done in my undergrad because I studied English, language and literature, but also secondary education, so specifically middle high school teaching methodology. I studied that in undergrad, so I didn't really want to rehash things that I had already studied, but I also knew I wanted something within the field of language teaching. So that struck me from the beginning as a good one to pursue. I would say the other two pieces that really made me want to do it and pursue it and run with it, because I took, I think, two or three classes in the TESOL program at Plymouth State before I officially applied and enrolled. And I did it for about 3 3.5 years on a part-time basis. But the second thing was I was noticing in my first few years of teaching that no matter what a student's background was, every student is a language learner. And I was really kind of struck by the disparity among some students, especially those who are, native speakers and have lived here their whole lives. And sort of the, I guess disconnect might even be a better word. The disconnect with each student for language skills. You have some kids who come to you in seventh grade, which is what I teach, who are really strong with their language skills, and others who just aren't there. And it's not always related to disability or to challenges. It's just that language learning is not a forte for them. So I saw it as a good opportunity to add a ton of tools to my toolbox as a language teacher. And the third thing that really made me want to do it was I started taking French as a middle schooler myself, and I quickly grew to love it. I always was a pretty passionate language learner anyway, but I definitely inherited my grandfather's love for foreign languages as well. And I studied French all through high school. I minored in it in college, and I did an experience in between my sophomore and junior year of college, 6 weeks with a family homestay in Paris. And I spoke French, 95% of the time. The only time I really didn't was with my fellow American students who I met in France and was studying with. And I learned basically what it was like to be somebody learning a language as a second or foreign language. So it was a fascinating experience, and my skills were really strong. I was close to advanced by the time I went to Paris, but I really got a lot out of it. And I thought to myself as I started working with students on all different levels through the years, wow, some of these kids come in and they have, intermediate to advanced language levels of English, but some come in with nothing. And I couldn't imagine that. But I did see people when I learned French in France who were in that same boat. And I admired it. And I felt like this was a good way for me to help some of those students on the different levels.
Absolutely. I love what you mentioned about French and language learning in general. So, I'm learning, as you know, I'm learning French too. So
Yep.
it's hard, but I love the language. And it puts me, when you are a language learner, it puts you in the whole process, in the psychological process. It helps you learn about yourself, what you are capable of, what you're afraid of, where your strengths and weaknesses. I felt stupid for the longest time. I still do, but I think the first stupid level has been overcome. Now it's the second stupid level,
Sure. Sure.
but it's like I look at my students who come in and they laugh at themselves when they try to pronounce a word, but if you try to pronounce a French word, you will laugh at yourself too. So it's like
Absolutely.
it's the same thing. But going back to your all students are language learners, it is such a complex, and I think we could almost record a different podcast episode just talking about language, because the environment shapes our language, the
Yes.
education shapes our language, what we're exposed to shapes our language. And when we see the kids, we have like the curriculum, right, that we have to present to them, and it's more or less the same thing. But they all come from so many different places. You have somebody who maybe the family doesn't communicate well, right? Or maybe somebody who doesn't feel the need to express themselves creatively. Somebody who reads a lot, which I noticed I had a student who students who like to read and read in their first language almost always
Yeah.
transfer, not almost always, they come in here, they're quiet for a little bit, and then boom, they're out. It's
Yeah.
because the transfer skills are so great. Those are that right. It's just so many complex ways that language is learned, and for you to navigate all of it, the native speakers who are higher and lower, the English learners who are beginning, middle, and high, so
Yep.
that is quite a dance that you have to do every single day, right?
Yeah. And I think it really, the transferability of the skills I learned in the TESOL Masters just to the classroom, especially when it's mixed the way it is with students on all different levels. We're not leveled at the middle school with honors and college prep and all of that. So you have to dance around a bit and cater to every student's needs. And that's one of the things I do enjoy about it, honestly.
Which brings me to the next question, right? So you and I, we've shared English learners, and we've shared ones that have been very gifted, and those who really, really struggled, right? So you have made lasting connections with all of them. Now, how do you help an English learner in a language arts classroom?
Yeah, it's a good question because, I think as much as it looks different in each classroom and with each teacher, when you're dealing with an English learner, there's so much that we share in common with how we approach these students. And I've always sort of taken it upon myself to look at each student who fits the EL profile and focus on kind of the varying needs of each of them. What would benefit, student A the most? What would benefit student B the most? And we know in a perfect world, it would be nice if, each student had the same profile in some ways, or not even the same profile, but if they needed the same things in the same order. But that's just not how it ends up working. So I find it really good to kind of get that diagnostic the first couple weeks of school and design instruction and curriculum and communication that kind of fits their language needs and abilities without, interfering too much with the rhythm of the class plan itself. So one of the things that can be really nice, especially in our district, because we have a low incidence population, most of our ELLs are included in the mainstream classroom setting throughout the day, minus when they see you, or minus if they maybe need to be pulled for something else small or minor. So I think when we consider that model, it gets really nice to be able to hit what they need and to do it throughout the year. And just kind of figuring out after those first few weeks what that might look like with student A and B, and sometimes C, because there have been years where I've had three or four ELLs in a class and they're all on different
Oh, yeah.
speaking
Oh,
levels.
yeah.
But it's really great because you can still touch the same curriculum with all your learners, but how you deliver it individually, I think, is the beauty of being able to differentiate. And that's something I really like to do. And I can think about, a situation the year that we ended up going remote for the last few months of school, when I think my teaching team had four or five ELLs that year, which is probably the highest that I've had in my years at Lurgio. But one of my classes had three ELLs and three different levels, and the things we had to do cater to each of their needs. It taught me a lot, and I think it ended up serving them well when I figured out and knew that one of them really needed reading support, one needed speaking and language, and the other one had a lot of it, but was just a little behind in writing because she was a little more advanced with the speaking. So it's kind of fascinating, but I really try to structure it based on the varying needs of each learner.
And I think that's the way that if whoever can do this, it helps you grow and it helps the students so much because then they are able to access the content that you're teaching. And language arts is not easy to access, especially with all those books and
Right.
with the grammar that is geared towards native speakers, So whenever you're able to meet them where they're at and build on that, that's going to be the biggest bang for your buck, right?
Definitely. And I think sometimes, we have to look at what we're teaching in the curriculum and realize that some of it is so focused on the American culture.
Oh,
And
yes.
that can make it harder, because one of the things we've really tried in my department is to diversify some of the stories that we use, or the poems, or just some of the short elements of what we read because of that. And it can be really hard for a new English student
Yeah.
to
I think
suddenly deal with that.
anything American culture and history related is really hard because there's no background knowledge. So you almost like have to like parallel, like a parallel building of that background with every single lesson that you teach, Like I know in seventh grade, there's the Outsiders, so
Yep.
American, So
Very.
you have to, the story is relatable on the human level very much. So that is good. But the little slang and the little, like the context is something
Yeah.
that can throw a person off completely.
Absolutely.
So, what do you love the most about your current role?
I really, really like working with designated groups of students throughout the academic year. I think that's the thing that, as a classroom teacher, you really, really get the chance to do that. And that's the part that sticks with me, because, day to day, you go through the ups and downs of the job and the environment, but you're with the same kids throughout the year. And I mentioned, the homeroom kind of home base that our students have. And year to year, that's a great way to connect, because those 20 or so kids develop a really strong connection with their homeroom teacher. And for me, that's what it's really all about, the ability to make those connections, academic and personal, because as much as it's about the academics, we in middle school care a lot about how the students feel and what's going on in their social emotional world and life. And I think we do a really good job of recognizing that. But that's a big piece for me too, because, sixth, seventh, eighth grade is not the easiest time for everybody. So it really makes my heart warm when I get notes a few years later from students with how well they're doing, and you
Yeah.
know, the lasting influence that I and my colleagues have had on them. That's the best part of the job for sure, the connections.
Absolutely. I totally agree. And my room is like right in the pod that you are. It is dynamic to say the least.
Oh, it
And
is. Yeah, this year especially.
so, okay, now what do you like the least about your current role?
I would tell people, you know, if they asked me just for something quick, grading papers gets old for sure. I have a little stack to finish this afternoon before I close my quarter grades. But I think, you know, 7 years in at this point at the same school and the same content and grade level, one of the things that gets challenging is sort of the repetition of the material. As much as we change things up, and we really do, we don't change things just for the sake of changing them. We usually do it with a lot of meaning. It can get hard because, like, you know, you mentioned the Outsiders, which I've taught the entire 7 years that I've been at Lurgio, and it's a favorite book of mine, and it's one I don't really get tired of. But sometimes, you know, if I have a story I'm teaching, or I think about my Greek mythology unit that we're really trying to revamp in a lot of positive ways, which will help. But sometimes you get to it, and as much as you might have a great group of students, or I'm really focused on what I mentioned loving about the role, which is the connections, you start to get a little less excited, I think, by aspects of the material. And for me, that's where I'm sort of currently at. And it's not like certain specials teachers, you know, who teach in the integrated arts or in different settings in school, they might change their groups throughout the year. They might change some of their goals year to year. So I even think about, like, you know, our cooking teacher. She usually does cook a lot of the same foods with the kids throughout the year, but she might decide to do a completely different lesson on one, or to incorporate a culture unit a little more. And I think the part I don't like as much is, as much as I do have autonomy with how I teach the material, because I work in a collaborative department with some really great fellow ELA teachers. You know, we have to stick to what our curriculum is, and we have a really strong one, and I like a lot of the pieces of it, but it can get a little dry year to year when there's similarity, even with a different group. So I think for me, it's at that point where, you know, I've been doing it for several years, and that's the part that gets a little more, I guess, mundane from time to time.
Yeah, I totally get that. For me, it's the opposite because I'm very, very
Correct.
open, and it's like sometimes I wish I had like something set in stone. But for me, the students, the levels, the everything changes, so I have to
Yep.
constantly like reinvent the wheel, you know?
Yeah, no kidding.
That does get old too.
Oh yeah, I'm sure.
So, what do you like or feel most comfortable teaching? Is it reading, writing, grammar, speaking, or?
Yeah, I've always been really at home with teaching reading. I think it was sort of what I was best trained in with my both undergraduate and graduate programs. But it's also because I'm a voracious reader myself, and I was at the age of the kids that I teach. It's the part that I'm really at home with. And I think you can reach kids in so many different ways through reading, even if you've got a common text that all 80-something kids are reading. You know, we really focus a lot on discussion and visual reinforcement. So with some of my books or stories, I have a graphic novel or a film version that I show while we're reading, after we read, or as we're reading. And I just think there's so many modalities to reach kids through reading. And that's the part that makes me smile day to day, because even kids who don't always love to read, or who classically might not like the book at hand, are able to get a lot out of it. And I think I do the best with teaching reading skills that will be transferable to them, for them year to year, and getting them ready for eighth grade and freshman year, kind of understanding the deep, close reading and the comprehension. That's really my wheelhouse, I would say.
Very, very cool. I'm an avid reader too. So for me,
Yeah.
a book is like, like a holy grail, right?
So
What
much.
I have discovered this year, because I've always, remember, we talked about 90 minutes, one student, right? Like,
Yeah.
what do you do? And the level is higher. So you're not going to like focus on the I am, kind of like grammar and vocabulary. I have a gift of a student who likes stories, who
Yep.
likes to read. And I have introduced in my classes for the first time, we're reading books
Nice.
in all my classes. We're reading books. Yes, we do the homework. Yes, we work on the language. And the beauty, at first I honestly, like at first I did like vocabulary pre-teaching. I did like the whole thing. By now, we're reading books.
Love it.
We read, and just the simple act of me reading out loud and the student being engaged naturally brings out the questions, naturally builds vocabulary,
Absolutely.
naturally makes them think, create inferences. It's the simple act of reading. I've discovered the beauty of it. So I totally am with you because it has so many levels, so many social emotional levels, and so many, mental levels. So I really, really love that.
Totally. It's awesome.
So let's talk about the elephant in the room. What would you say is the biggest problem that regular education teachers encounter when they have an English learner in the classroom?
It's really one of the best questions you can ask to kind of get to the, I think, chronic problem of people
Yeah. My
not
gosh.
knowing what to do. And I would simply say that that's, the easiest answer to start with, or the easiest way to start. People just don't really know what to do. Even the best teachers who've been doing it for the longest time, they freeze, or they think, oh, I've never done this, or it's been several years since I've done it. And I'm not sure why that is the case so much with ELLs especially, because we've all been in situations where, you have a student who has a particular need that maybe you haven't focused on or dealt with as much year to year, or it's been a while. I know some colleagues this year who are working with, a deaf student, and many of them, it's their first time or first time in many years. And even that doesn't have the total, oh, let me freeze reaction that I think a lot of very well-intended regular ed teachers just don't. They just don't know exactly what to do. And I think in the past it was a, let's treat this, new student, new speaker, new American, or even, a student who's been here for several years but just hasn't mastered the language. Let's kind of approach it as if they're an outsider. And I don't think that's the healthiest way to do it, because these are kids who, like many of our, ancestors, people like me who've, my family's been in America for multiple generations now, but this is the same boat that many people's ancestors were in, coming from other countries where they spoke other languages. And we know that a lot of the history shows that these folks were treated as outsiders, and these folks had to navigate on their own. And I think there's a way to better address it with our regular education teachers who are struggling to cater their instruction to the needs of this group of students. And I've often wondered if there's just better approaches that, college prep programs can take and states can take. And I know some states have good requirements or things in place for teachers in the mainstream setting, but some states don't, or some programs don't. And we really focus a lot of our attention in teacher prep on especially certain situations that absolutely warrant learning about. But it's not the same for language learners. And I think everybody would benefit from a little more background that feels like it will help them too, because I've also seen situations where programs are put in place or things are put in place, but they don't really help teachers. It's more just a, oh, here's an online video you can watch with a, sort of overview, and it's not personalized in the way that it can be. So I think that's just the reality. People really struggle and they freeze, and they don't know how to approach it as much. It's hard.
I have so much to say about this, and
Yeah, I bet.
So, number one, that's what I do, what I do. That's why I do this podcast, okay? Because I
Yep.
want to spread information. That's why I started my programs and started consulting for teachers, you know? And that's why I start, like, that's why this is the heart of what I do.
It is.
The fact that you totally said that everybody freezes, and I'm still trying for some reason in our minds. If you don't speak a language, there's something other about you, and we focus on the other and not on
Yes.
the human connection. So whenever somebody asks me what is the first step, and I say make a connection with the student, it seems too easy. But this
Right.
basis, it's the basis of all the things. The curriculum is not going to stick if you don't have a connection with the student. Nothing
Exactly.
is going to stick if the student doesn't feel safe, seen, and heard in whatever language and whatever capacity in your classroom. So I think when some say, this is it, yes, this is it. For the first step is this is it. We can go to the curriculum later. I think a
Yeah.
lot of times I want to give credit to teachers. Everyone is under so much pressure to deliver curriculum, to meet the standards. Everybody, you know, the observations, the contracts,
Yeah.
the responsibility, the accountability. I get that, and I think that is a big part of the freeze moment,
Oh,
right?
totally, totally.
I think, and that is, yes, we can say the other, but also like, okay, so I have this student, like, how is it going to reflect on me, right? How is
Totally.
it going to reflect on my performance? But then again, we do this one step at a time, one day at a time, and
Yeah.
it takes time, and it's, you know, we don't always have the support, but I think that if it is important, if I had a message for all teachers, is it is important to just pause and start making a connection, because once you take the first step, then the next step is going to be revealed, right?
Yeah.
So I think making a connection and then learning, just like you do, diagnostic where the student is at. And of course, talk to your EL teacher. Of
Well, yeah, and
course.
I think you're hitting the nail on the head with so many of the pieces there. And as I said earlier, the heart of what I do and what I love is the connection piece. And so many of my colleagues and our faculty in the middle school, it's the same thing and it's the same approach. And I think it's a bit of a they freeze and then they realize, oh, wait a minute, it's the same type of situation. It's just that there's a language barrier, and that's going to be the obstacle that, we have to figure out or that I have to get around. And I can still make the connection in other ways. And some of the most successful situations that I've seen have been people doing just that. I can recall a colleague who really tried hard to make a connection with one of our girls a few years ago, because they had some common interests and things, and it helped so much. It was wonderful.
So, where do you see yourself in 5 years?
It's a good question, and it's always sort of the hot topic among people, because when I first started in the classroom, and before I was sort of seriously enrolled in the TESOL program for my master's, I had a couple different things in my head. I had a couple different paths in mind when I first began in the classroom. And for a long time, at the first few years, it was leadership would be where I'd end up, or a leadership role. And over time, I think I've realized a few things. I definitely feel that I could do very well in that role. And I do ultimately, in the 5-year time frame, see myself in a curriculum leadership role or a general leadership role, maybe working more closely with ELL students or some type of language program type piece. But I realized, 3, 4 years in, that I really was benefiting from multiple years in the classroom. I'm 8 years in total and 7 at Lurgio, and I'm learning still day to day. And I think some of the best leaders, curriculum directors, people who work on program coordination of any type, some of these folks have spent 10 to 20 years in the classroom, and that's so beneficial. So if I am still in the ELA role in 5 years, I'm sure I'll still be very happy. I would not want to be doing anything else but teaching or working in education. But I do kind of see myself moving into more of a supervisory or curriculum role, and whether that's, English learning in general, mainstream and ELL, or more ELL focused, I'm not sure. But definitely something a little different, perhaps, than what I'm doing now would be ideal in the 5-year time frame, I'd say.
Yeah, that is a question. When somebody asks me, I'm like, what am I even allowed to want in 5 years?
No kidding. No
You
kidding.
know, it's like I have these like grand ideas, and I'm like, 5 years, it's not that long, but it's like,
Yeah,
but I
yeah.
like how you articulated it, you know, and I actually see you in the leadership role, the way you work, I can see you. So I would not be surprised if you are, a leader somewhere in our district.
Yeah, it would be ideal for sure, because I like where I work. The district is certainly a big part of it. Yeah.
So, in your opinion, how can all teachers set up their classrooms for success?
I think adaptability is really the key that I see with setting things up. I even think about the way a classroom's laid out. And year to year, I have some things that, stay very similar. Like I keep a very similar bulletin board at the beginning of the year, and I kind of keep it up through various parts of the year. But being adaptable to your group of learners year to year is super helpful for success, because I know there have been times where I've had groups that benefit so much from a certain group structure with how they manage their work and how they structure their own learning in my classroom. And then maybe the next quarter, even when we switch to a new novel, it's not the same type of need or same type of ability with the kids. So I think being really adaptable to what you need and what your kids need, willing to learn from your students based on their feedback, that's something that I think helps me a lot with setting up my classroom, because, I might have a great plan in place or idea, or it might be, oh, I've done this type of structure with the outsiders unit for the last 3 years, so let's just do it the same way again. It's easy. But then you realize from your kids or from the other adults who you're working with in your room that maybe something else is needed, or maybe there's a great idea. I mean, I've had paraprofessionals share some fabulous ideas with me over the years for teaching material that I didn't think of. And it's the collaboration piece for me. That's really important. And often when people, offer something like that, whether it's a student, a fellow teacher, a para, it's not them being critical. It's them being helpful and saying like, hey, I think this would be a great addition here. And, it might set you up for success with this unit. And I've had that happen more times than not. And I would say 90% of the time I've followed that suggestion and it's worked out really well. So for me, adaptability, because no one year is the same, no one group of learners is the same. And I think we know that those teachers who really don't focus as much on adaptability, or who are stuck in the way that they've been doing it for, many, many years, don't always end up serving the group at hand the way that they could if they were a little more open to suggestions and changes and things.
I totally agree with you. I love it. Sometimes it's hard to take suggestions because, it
It
depends
is.
on the personality. You may perceive it as criticism, but I have staying open helps you being adaptable, right?
Oh,
And
absolutely.
I have had ideas because sometimes I find myself in like a tunnel, like, okay, I'm doing everything, but like, where is the kicker? What's happening? And
Yeah.
then I ask the kids. And then the kids say, hey, could we do it this way? And you know what? It comes out amazing because everybody's learning and it takes the pressure off of me. So I
Yeah.
totally agree with that.
Yeah, and often the kids are right about it, and it's easy to figure out when it's a good suggestion too,
Yeah.
because if they're making it seriously as opposed to in a goofy manner or trying to get off from doing a certain part of the work, we're trained well enough to know when
Yeah.
they're serious about it too.
Absolutely. Well, Zach, this has been a fantastic pleasure. So many good gems. I am like thinking, which quotes should I share with people? Because we touched upon so many good topics. That
Totally.
could almost each be developed into a separate podcast episode, wouldn't you agree?
I think so. Yeah. We may have to consider that for the future because there's so much that that could be helpful for that for sure.
So, where can people find you and connect with you, if they have questions or if they just want to follow you?
Yeah, I'm actually somebody at this point. I'm pretty off social media these days, minus sort of personal non-school connected pages, but email is certainly an easy way. My school email, I can you can link it certainly in the episode if you want, because I'm always open and I find it really easy to make those connections that way. I also have a LinkedIn page that I can share with you as well,
Oh,
because
that'd be great.
people, yeah, people can connect with me there from the professional side as well, for sure.
Well, thank you again for your time and for your wisdom, Zach. And thanks everyone for listening. And until next time.
Thank you, Yeva.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode. If you loved what you heard today, be sure to do two things. First, make sure to subscribe to the ESL Teaching Podcast so you don't miss an episode. And second, leave a positive review wherever you listen, on iTunes, Spotify, or any other platform. Positive reviews will improve the chances of this podcast to be discovered in the feed and help our fellow ESL ELL teachers. And of course, there's a third thing. If you aren't following me on social media yet, come join me on Instagram at Simply Yeva ESL, Facebook Simply Yeva, or connect with me on my website, simplyyeva.com. Thanks again, and until next time.